you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to another episode of Kotaku Split Screen. My name is Kirk Hamilton. It's June 23rd, 2016, and we are excited to be safe and sound back home, rested and recovered from E3. Today on the show, Jason Schreier and I will be talking about what we thought of the new Zelda, which he had a chance to play. We'll also be talking about what we thought of E3 more generally. The big game on our agenda is Overwatch, a very good game that the two of us are playing quite a bit of. Torbjorn is overpowered. We'll close out the episode with some bonus talk about the latest episode of Game of Thrones, the exciting Battle of the Bastards. There's a whole lot to talk about. We're very excited to be back with you, so we hope you stick around. All right, and we are back in the studio with the full theme song ready for an actual full episode of Kotaku Split Screen. Hi, Jason. How's it going?
Hi, Kirk. How are you? It's been a little while. We should explain why we missed the promised day 4 episode.
Yeah, we were
E3.
On such a roll. It was going great, and then of course something went
wrong.
So
what happened is on Friday morning I woke up at about 6:30 Pacific time, and we were planning on recording that morning and doing like everything I saw on Thursday and did on Thursday that episode, and then at 6:30 I checked my email and it's like an email from Virgin America saying your flight has been canceled. Mm-hmm. And so Steven and I spent the next couple hours scrambling and trying to find a new flight, which was kind of a disaster.
Writing Kotaku posts while doing Kotaku all that. Posts. I was impressed. That's you guys true. Did give us stuff to publish that day, which was looking pretty dry.
It was ridiculous. Virgin is such a fucking disaster. Never fly Virgin
America. I like Virgin. Really? Are they bad?
Oh my God.
I've been canceled out of LAX as well. I think like 2 E3s ago that happened.
Well, so what they said was they ran out of crew, which is the worst possible excuse. And also, so they didn't even have any nonstop flights they could get us on. So they made us fly to San Francisco, like have a layover, a 3-hour layover, although we wound up getting on an earlier flight back to New York. But it was ridiculous. To their credit, at least the woman at the desk in San Francisco was really nice and gave us a little bit of a seat upgrade to an exit row for our trip back to New York. But it was a disaster. So
nice.
We did not have time to record. So day 4 of E3 will forever go unsung.
It basically just didn't happen at this point. It's faded from memory.
I did play Zelda, and I can talk about that a little bit, but it was kind of like looking back at E3 real quick and just like doing a kind of like
post-mortem. Let's do that.
It was kind of a slow E3.
I agree.
Do you think?
I thought it was disappointing from here. I was like not very jazzed about many things.
Well, there were no surprises. Like I can't think of one thing that was really a surprise.
I guess it was partly that, and that because of that, all of the things I saw were things that are already kind of known quantities. Like it was just, it was like I was excited about a couple games, right? Like Gravity Rush 2, but also I know Gravity Rush 2 is going to be like Gravity Rush, and like I thought that Dishonored 2 thing, like we talked about on the podcast earlier, was cool, but also that's like I already kind of know that game's coming out. So yeah, there wasn't a sort of holy shit moment. I'd say maybe Horizon Zero Dawn for me was a little bit like, oh wow, that game's more than I thought it would be. But generally,
yeah.
No.
But that looked just as cool last year. A lot of it felt like just a rehash of last year because so many games showed off at last year's show.
Yeah,
just never having to come out. Actually, I was just thinking Sony's conference was the best of them because it was the best paced and showed the most games, and it was just like no fluff whatsoever. But it would have been so much more powerful if they, instead of doing The Last Guardian last year and then just not talking about it for a year and then re-revealing it again at this point when nobody really cares about it, what they should have done was waited until this E3, not talked about it at all last year, done a thing at this E3, suddenly come out and be like, Last Guardian, it's really
coming
alive,
out this fall.
And it's coming this October. And then suddenly the hype would have been there because now there's like nobody really is that jazzed about The Last Guardian. I mean, people will play it and it'll probably suck.
Yeah, but, I mean, even then, I just feel like all of this is like horse jockeying between like different marketing events, and it just is all very like that.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with getting excited over marketing events.
Of course not, but too much of the like, well, they would have done better if they'd marketed it this way. Like, to me, at least, I start to lose interest. I'm just sort of
but
like,
that's
yeah,
what E3 is. When we're doing a postmortem on E3, that's exactly what we're talking about.
I guess, yeah, I don't know. I think it still comes down to, for me, like, when I see something that I really want to play, like, it's less about sure. what people got excited about or how effectively they got people excited, and more just, like, I watched a ton of streams of games, and, like, if a game looks fun, at least then I'm like, oh, this looks cool. I'm, like, taking the time to watch all these games, even though those streams seem like they happen all year now.
Right, I agree with that, but imagine if you had seen The Last Guardian and you wanted to play that last year, versus wanting to play it this year and actually getting to play it this year, it would have been such a different experience, I think. But so speaking of games I want to play, South Park: The Fractured But Whole is the first game I've ever pre-purchased. I bought the game and the season pass, the whole like gold edition or whatever. So I spent $90 on this game that doesn't come out till December.
I hope it doesn't suck.
Here's why. Well, first of all. Okay, two compelling reasons, even though I've never pre-purchased games and I'm very anti-pre-ordering in general. First of all, by buying it digitally, I get a free copy of South Park Stick of Truth on PS4 that I can play right now. So I already have that on my PS4. So that in itself is a pretty solid reason to pre-order. It's better than like all the other costumes and other nonsense perks that companies give you. Second reason is I'm going to have to buy it anyway because Ubisoft has us blacklisted and they're not going to send us review copies. Mm-hmm. So I figured why not just buy the game and the season pass because I would have to do that in December anyway. Are those compelling enough reasons?
The second one isn't. The first one is. I think that
the second one, just justifies like me just buying it.
I guess
the whole deal.
I mean, but that's also just like that's just like a lot of people pre-order because they're like, look, I'm going to buy this game no matter what, so I might as well.
No, but for us, it's like for me, it's like I'm going to buy it no matter what because I'm going to be telling Kotaku readers whether it's
course,
I'm going to be reviewing it.
Of course, but so. I think the first reason is a much more compelling reason. Like, if there is a reason, if there is a good reason to pre-order a game, it's because you get something right now that's cool and free that you would have paid for. I mean, like, all right. Also, what happens if you cancel your pre-order?
You can't because it's digital. Digitally, it's impossible to cancel pre-orders.
Right. Well, actually, I've done it, but it's not exactly a cancel. It's like you're asking for a refund. So it's a slightly
different
deal.
And I think they would like take away my code, I imagine. I don't
know.
What
if you use the code if you like download the sticker?
No, I already have it on my PS4. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
It'd be underhanded. I bet there are people who will do that.
Yeah, it's a shitty thing to do.
Yeah.
And especially since that's such a good perk, and like I wish more companies would do that.
And like
I would
pre-order
more
like,
games.
They're both good games; like they deserve.
Yeah, although
support.
I must even the PS4 version has the same like stuttering issues that I ran into.
You
on
sure that the stuttering issue isn't in your head?
I promise you, it's not in my head. I'm going to capture some video and show you.
Okay, I'll watch it.
But anyway, so E3 in general pretty slow. I would say the game that. Everyone, every single person at the show, from developers to press to even other PR people, the game everyone was talking about was Zelda.
Yes.
Which is not a shocker after that trailer and all that live stream footage and whatnot. I got to play a bit, which was set inside of Nintendo's crazy Zelda booth, which must have cost them many millions to build because it was a giant kind of Zelda theme park with movable walls. Like you go in and they give you a little presentation and this wall opens up and they let you inside and all these demo stations and grass and giant statues and like it feels like you're in a theme park basically. Like you look up and there are these big screens with the sky on them and there's a day-night cycle for the screens and they all make noise and like you hear birds chirping and like you look up and suddenly it's nighttime. It was crazy. So then I went and Nintendo's folks ushered me up to go play the game. So there are two different demos. One of them is a story demo that just starts off from the beginning of the game. And all this stuff has been shown online. So like there's nothing I did that hasn't been seen or any in the bazillion hours of footage that people have seen of the new Zelda game. Mm-hmm. But so the story intro is just the stuff we saw at the beginning of the game, and then there's a kind of an open world demo where it just drops you in the middle of something with a few abilities and tells you to go off and do stuff. It's cool. It's I mean, what you would expect. It's like a cross between Skyrim and Assassin's Creed and Far Cry and Metal Gear Solid. It's and Don't Starve. It's like a combination of all those things. I'm a little bit worried that after a few hours it might get kind of boring and old, but who knows.
Do you think that any, like, it sounded to me like the demo was just the open world stuff and not any of the structured stuff. Like, they're saying they're going to be like real dungeons and you're going to get all these upgrades and it's going to work like a Zelda game, even though it has this also this sort of open world exterior. The feeling that I got was that the demo was just this open world sandbox stuff that you can do, and of course that would get old. So, but if you're also like in any open world game, if you're like taking the time to then go do a big dungeon, and then in between you're kind of screwing around in the open world, that'll change the pacing significantly.
Well, hold on. So there are no big dungeons in the demo, correct?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
There are the smaller dungeons, the shrines. Yeah. Did you see those?
Yeah, and those are more open worldy. Those are like in a Ubisoft game. Like, there will be in the world puzzle, you know, mini dungeons that aren't quite the same as when you go do a story mission that goes to a whole new location with all kinds of new stuff.
Yeah, and then so it'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see if they can, like, really justify hundreds of hours of going around and, like, sneaking into enemy camps and taking out guards.
Really?
And, like,
I feel like they totally will. I think that game looks so good. Like, I don't
know. I agree.
I would be surprised
if
they didn't justify it.
Yes, no, I totally agree. But the question will be, like, are the rewards good enough from these enemy camps? Or, like, am I going to have incentive to actually do a lot of this stuff?
It's interesting, do you think that, like, there needs to be an incentive? Because it just looked pretty... Like, do you think that it could just be fun to screw
around? Yeah, if you're playing for a few hours and you've already gotten, like, your rocks off doing a couple of enemy camps, then you kind of need more reasons to do it. And especially Zelda games have been bad at giving you good rewards for stuff. Like, often you'll do all these challenging things and just get, like, 50 rupees or whatever. So that's a little bit of a concern. I think having the gear system will help, because you might be able to, say, go take down a moblin camp and get a way better sword and stuff like that. That'll be really interesting to see. It'll also be interesting to see how they do, like, level scaling, and whether different sections of the, whether everything scales up with you, or whether different sections are based on different levels. The latter seems like it would be the smarter approach.
Yeah, I felt like a lot of the enemies I was watching in the demo were the things that felt the least interesting to me, like, compared when I was comparing it to, say, Far Cry, where there's actually sort of complicated AI and animals mixing with humans, and people are smart about chasing you around. It seemed to me like once any of the demonstrators I watched got into fights, they were sort of just
all moblins stuff though, at you in this demo. Yeah. There were no other enemies.
Right. So I guess the question is, yeah, are there going to be other?
Yeah, for sure. There will be, like, the Staphos and Wizrobes and all the other Zelda creatures. Skeleton Knights and the Wizards are the Staphos and the Wizrobes. But yeah, I'm excited. Very optimistic, but cautiously optimistic. I'm a little worried about the whole Link Between Worlds problem, where it's like dungeons are simplified because the game won't know if you have certain items when you go into the dungeon, unless they find ways to you have to have different combinations of things to get into each dungeon, and they could definitely find ways to make it work. And
they haven't talked about that.
No.
Or if there's going to be like a rental system like there was.
And I don't even know how many items there will be in the first place. It might just be like you get some abilities on your Sheikah Stone and you use those to navigate through dungeons. But yeah, I mean, the game feels really good. It's kind of rough visually, so I'm really excited to see if it looks better on NX, assuming the NX is more powerful than the Wii U, which I hope is the case.
It's a safe assumption, at least.
Unless they go, like, low-powered, like, we're making a phone. I don't know. Who knows? But anyway, yeah, I'm excited to see how it looks on the NX, because there's, like... So the frame rate is generally pretty stable. It gets some chugging at points when there's a lot going on. But everything is... It's not... The art direction is phenomenal, but you can tell that this is a Wii U game. Like, you're looking around at these big vistas, and it's like, oh, my God, I wish this was on a more powerful system.
Man, it's so funny how quickly it went from, wow, like, look at how good Mario Kart looks on Wii U. This is what a next-gen Nintendo game looks like, to, like, fuck, I wish this game was running on a more
It's really a drag. I mean, Nintendo's, as we discussed in our Nintendo is a Bummer episode, Nintendo's strategy this past generation has really been a drag. But yeah, I'm really excited for the game. It's really cool from what I saw. You can get headshots on enemies, which is crazy. Have you ever gotten headshots in a Zelda game?
That's not very Nintendo. Yeah. Has there ever been headshots in a Nintendo game? Probably.
I think someone pointed out to me on Kotaku that Metroid Prime Hunters had headshots.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, it would be a Metroid game if there was a game.
But yeah, it's cool. I'm excited. So the other big game that we have to discuss today is something that you and I were playing last night.
A real game that's actually out.
A video game that's actually out. I don't know how real it is. A little something called Overwatch.
Yes.
I am really terrible at Overwatch, and this is a problem because it feels like the type of game where I would have to play many, many hours to get good. And I don't know if I have room for another game like that in my life.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure what it would take to get good at Overwatch. Man, it's a good game.
Well, like, I just feel like I would have to learn the exact nuances of every single character, when to use each character against who.
Yeah, it depends on how good you need to be. Like, we've been playing with big groups. I was playing with a big group after you went to bed last night with a bunch of our Destiny people. And
I didn't go to bed. I went to play Zero Time Dilemma.
After you went to go play a game. After you went to not go to bed. But I was playing with more people, and what I've found is, I think if you were playing solo, it would take a long time to master or to get good at. But playing with people, I mean, it's amazing how, when you're all on the same team, everyone has a vested interest in you getting good. So it's amazing how, like, happily people just share tips with you and tell you what to do. And, like, I'm learning so quickly. I learned so much last night. Yeah. Just playing for maybe four or five hours.
Well, I don't know. So I've been playing Widowmaker mostly, and I feel like I'm good at sniping just because I've played so much Destiny, and it's sort of similar with their scope and everything. But I don't really have a sense for, like, where on the map to be and what all the maps are and, like...
Oh, well, that's just, like, yeah, that's
how
true.
To defend, like, the payload or whatever.
The thing is, there aren't that many maps. I'm already finding that I know
the
maps.
You know the maps? Okay.
And then, pretty well. And the maps do a good... There's so much smart stuff in this game. Like, the way the map draws lanes out and the way the levels are designed to kind of really clearly identify different areas. There are, like, tricks, and there are places where snipers or, like, Pharah will, like, climb up to a super high spot that you didn't realize she could get to, and she'll get you, and then next time you'll kind of make a note of that. But the actual layout of the levels, I find, is pretty easy to keep track of once I play them a few times. And there aren't that many. I think people who are playing really hardcore are complaining that there aren't enough maps. Where for me, it's kind of nice. I can understand why Blizzard would launch it with not that many maps.
Yeah, so you
because people
get
who
the
are,
hang of
yeah,
them all.
Yeah, because that, like, once you know the map, it gets really fun. And I think, like, once everybody knows the map, it gets really fun because it becomes more about this, like, positional strategy stuff. And call-outs make so much more sense. Like, once you know when someone's like, you know, oh, Lucio, he's over on the left. Like, you know, we've got this guy coming from the right. Oh, there's a Reinhardt coming above us. You know there's only one above us area.
Yeah.
And it kind of just makes it easier to play.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, so I was playing as Pharah for a while last night, and I, like, kind of felt like I was kind of getting the hang of, like, floating around and just, like, pummeling people with rockets and stuff. But, like, I don't know. It still felt like I wasn't being as optimally efficient as, like, when I'm playing Trials. I know when I'm doing really well.
Yeah, but you've played, like, 3 hours of Overwatch or something.
No,
of course that's going to be true.
I've played a bunch since May, just not enough to be, like... Like, everyone I know who plays Overwatch has been playing every single night for the past month. And that's, like, the type of commitment I just can't get into right now with another game, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't played that much. I've played, like, two nights, and I felt like I was playing as Lucio a lot and really getting down how to play Lucio well. And there was I just started playing with randoms.
Well, it's easier to be support, I think, than it is to be a...
It depends. Like, I think it's easier to be Lucio, but not to play Lucio well. Like, playing Lucio well takes a whole... You have to know the level. You have to know, like, where you want to be and where you don't want to be. It's super about mobility, so you have to have, like, all your escape plans kind of charted out in your head because you can move so much faster than everybody else that as long as you can do that, you're really hard to kill. But if you don't know what you're doing, like, you can still totally screw it up.
Right.
It's a good beginner class, but that's kind of the thing. like, I had a ton of fun, and I don't really feel like I'm going to need to learn how to play McCree anytime soon, you know? Like, for now, I'm like, okay, I've got Lucio pretty good. I've got D.Va pretty good. I'm getting Mercy pretty good. Like, I'll probably learn, like, I was playing Pharah last night, and I was getting okay at Pharah.
Pharah's fun.
And it feels like, yeah, Pharah's great. Oh, man, I have a great capped footage of just, Pharah's really good for kind of having ultimate plays, like, because her ult just can kill the whole other team. So you can get, I got to a very high vantage point and felt like I was very good at video games for about 20 minutes, which was nice.
Well, you were good at video games for 20 minutes. Congrats.
Yeah, it was enough. It was enough. I would take
That's
it,
all you need. So people say that, like, Pharah and Soldier and stuff are good for beginner players. Do you think this is a type of game? Well, so, like, I see people switching around a bunch. Do you think this is the type of game where you can, like, get really good at, like, two characters or three characters and
I think if you have a group you play with, and we, you know, that I've got a couple of groups now, but I think if you have a regular group that you play with, people will gravitate to certain roles, and you can start to specialize. Like, it's harder to specialize when you're playing with randoms, I find, just because a lot of times I just sort of look at the team makeup and say, okay, well, we don't have a tank, so I'm going to play as Reinhardt. Like, we don't have a healer, so I guess I'll play as Mercy. And that's more just adjusting. But I think everyone will probably get, like, one tank, one support, one offense, and one healer that they're good at and be able to do that. But then on a team, yeah, I would imagine it'll work really well.
What's your opinion on Reaper?
I think Reaper is corny but also hilarious. Like, oh man, last night one of the people we were playing with got an emote for him. Have you seen this emote? Like,
no.
He does the like slow thumb across the throat thing, and it's like he like looks at you and is like and like draws his thumb across the throat, and it's so corny and bad and like also perfect. I think the spray paint I have for him is this extremely corny like Reaper face. His whole deal, I just feel like they're going to do, you know, one of those short videos for Reaper, and it's going to just be the worst thing ever.
He's just going to be like a teenage, like, edgelord, like, sitting in his room listening to Linkin Park. And just,
you know,
like,
he's probably like a metal guitarist or something, because doesn't he, like, have a guitar that he wears on his back, or he's, like, in a mariachi band or something, so...
Yeah.
There'll be some story where, like, his whole band gets killed by Overwatch, and then he gets angry at them or something. I don't know.
Man.
It's gonna be bad. He's corny. There was a time, oh man, a few funny things have happened with him. We were playing, and he said something. He, like, you know how there are team-wide call-outs? And it was like, if we just keep pressure on, we'll finally be able to take this point. Like, it was something kind of, like, team-oriented, which he doesn't actually usually do. And so it just really stuck out, and it was super funny, since most of his are like, die, die, you know, just, like,
die,
yelling,
die, die,
random aggression. It was him kind of talking to the team and, like, being like, all right, guys, let's go. And I was like, Reaper, this isn't really
But he's
you,
so
man.
Annoying to play against.
Yeah, he's great. He's fun to play as. I've had a lot of a really good time playing as him. He seems
and Tracer seem like very similar type of.
Yeah, well, they both have like a
characters.
Get out of jail. Yeah, like a get out of jail thing. Though he does a lot more damage than she does. But yeah, did you've seen Reaper names? The Twitter
yeah,
account.
Of course.
You saw the milk. There was this one. I'll tell readers about it. I think you saw it. The best one ever is like the guy's wearing the white Reaper outfit, uh-huh. And his name is the Milkman.
Nice.
And then in chat, you see him say, "The milk has been delivered."
Oh my
which
goodness!
Is so good on so many levels.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, Reaper is fine. I actually like playing as Reaper. He's one of the offensive characters I play as. Reaper and Pharah.
Yeah, I wish more characters had iron sights and like you could use a scope the way you can with Widowmaker.
Yeah, I don't know, I guess. Have you played as Hanzo at all?
For like a second, not really.
Yeah, he's another sniper character, so.
He has a bow, right?
Yeah, has a bow. And can do, I'm not really clear on his moveset yet. He's one person that I've been like, okay, I'm not really going to go there for a while and just kind of keep learning these easier to handle characters, but
one thing I like about Overwatch, by the way, is that it feels like, even though it'll take me many, many hours to master, it's good at letting you just jump in for 10 minutes, play a quick match, and then just duck out. Like, it's a very easy game to play casually, which I appreciate as someone who doesn't have a ton of time to play extra games.
For me, a big part of that is the fact that there's no carrot stick thing. Like, I'm not trying to unlock anything really meaningful, and I don't care really about skins. Like, some of the skins are cool and I want them, but I don't care. And I really, like, to me, that makes the game feel so much more relaxed than something like Destiny or even Call of Duty with, like, tiered unlocks where you rank up. It just, it makes me feel like, all right, I can just play this and whatever. I'm not missing out on anything if I play
casually.
So
you're saying that you don't want a Yallerhorn in Overwatch?
Basically, yes. And I hope, I have a feeling they're not interested in this, in that kind of thing.
No, like of course not.
Or just, like, prestige, and then you get, like, you know, like, it's, you know, in Call of Duty, like, you literally, like, get, or it was in Titanfall was the last game I played like this, where I would get a better gun with, like, better sights because I had played for 6 hours and unlocked it. And I hate that feeling. Like, I've learned that I hate that feeling. Where on Overwatch, it's funny, almost, I'm considering buying it on PC as well, because I want to play it on PC too, and I wouldn't, normally I would never consider that because I'd be like, oh, I've got all this stuff I already unlocked on PS4, and I don't want to deal with, you know, doing that all over again. But in Overwatch, I just don't have as many skins or, like, spray paints, but I don't care. And I can just play the game with mouse and keyboard and, like, kind of, you know, have a different experience, but it's the same game. And I think that's, like, a huge point in its favor.
Do you think it's the type of game that people have to have friends playing it to really enjoy? Like, to if I'm a Kotaku listener, split screen listener listening to this right now and wondering if I should buy Overwatch and spend time with it, but I don't know anyone who's playing it, is it worth my time?
I can't. I don't know. I haven't played enough solo to say. I would imagine the answer is somewhere in the middle, like, maybe. But I think that it's definitely more fun with friends, like, if you have that option. Because I was playing solo after playing with a group, and that was fun, too. Because it was just kind of random, and I was screwing around. And, like, I kept earning XP and getting stuff, so I didn't really care, and it was fun. And I was just playing Lucio.
Do they keep track of your KD ratio, by the way?
I think they do. I think that all those stats are tracked, but they're harder to track down, and they don't always show you. I'm not sure KD is, like, a thing that's displayed in the game, but I'm sure there are outside apps that can tell you, or even Battle.net if you go and look. I'm not sure, though.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, playing as a, you know, playing with randoms was fun, but it was fun as a just kind of more, even more casual thing after playing in a team where we're all communicating and trying to win really actively. But not having that, I would definitely feel like I would be way less likely to play for starters. Mm-hmm. So it would be more likely to be a game where I'm like, hey, I got this for $60. And now a couple weeks later, I'm just sort of not playing it. I think people just have to ask themselves, though, like, is that the kind of game I would play for a long time or not? Mm-hmm. And you know, and kind of know from there.
All I would say to people who are checking out Overwatch or just playing Overwatch for the first time is do not play as Mei, because Mei sucks.
I was looking at, on Planet Overwatch, this guy does this, like, really kind of amazing meta analysis where he looks at who plays which game or which characters and kind of, like, judges the changes over time. And I'm not totally sure how he's getting his data, and I'm sure that kind of thing is going to, like, evolve over time. But he's looking at, like, after the first nerf, sort of how things changed, because they nerfed Widowmaker and they nerfed McCree. And you can look at how people, like, nobody plays as Widowmaker anymore, because, like, Widowmaker was...
I do.
Was OP. Well, Jason Schreier, there's actually a picture of you here on the screen. But nice. I was surprised because at the bottom, Mei, Hanzo, Zen, what's his name? Zen, the healing guy that everybody thinks sucks.
Zenyatta,
yeah, that sounds right. And Torbjorn are all F tier, like, they're bottom tier, which is crazy to me because I see people play Mei all the time. And
yeah,
Mei
wait,
is,
Torbjorn I thought was the most overpowered.
He is. Well, he is, and it's weird because I wonder if this is first off based on PC, because... So to back up with the Torbjorn thing, well, so Mei was surprising because I see people play Mei all the time. Torbjorn is weird because, right, Torbjorn seems OP. It's almost like...
Yeah, his turrets are ridiculous.
So there, I know there are counters, and I was saying this, I was talking in our Overwatch Slack channel and saying, like, you know...
Wait, we have an Overwatch Slack channel?
Yeah. Are you not in it?
No.
Oh, man. I think maybe they assumed you weren't playing.
Wow.
I'll invite you.
Wow.
Harsh overlook.
Have you guys been just talking about me in this Overwatch
section? We're like, man, I'm so glad we don't play with Jason. He's the worst.
Wow.
He plays Widowmaker all the time, and it's such a bummer.
He doesn't capture the point.
He just snipes.
Camps enemies.
Well, so I said, I've been saying this, like, we've been playing on PS4, and every night I've played, when we're playing, you know, on defense or on attack, Torbjorn is just wrecking shit, like, on PS4. Like, every play of the game is some Torbjorn, like, not doing anything while his turrets kill everybody. So, to anybody who doesn't play Overwatch, Torbjorn is, like, the engineer character. So, he builds a turret that then he can kind of level it up. If you're smart, you level it up to rank 2. And then it just owns people, and you don't even have to do anything. You can kind of just sit back. And then when he uses his ultimate, it, like, turns his turret into a level 3 turret that'll just kill anything. And so, mm-hmm. if you're going up against, like, 3 Torbjorns on a team, it's just this crazy... You're trying to get into a, like, impenetrable, like, kill zone of these turrets, and then he's shooting you too, and it just becomes super frustrating and not fun and difficult. And we just sit around. I mean, everyone on our team is just constantly saying Torbjorn is extremely overpowered. His turret's just ridiculous. Where I was saying that, and, like, Chris Person, our video guy, plays on PC, and he was like, "Nah, Torbjorn isn't OP at all. Like, you can counter him with this character with Genji and whoever else." And I think on PC, it's less of an issue.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
My sense is that on PS4, Torbjorn is an issue because people are less accurate in general on PS4, but Torbjorn's turret is not inaccurate. It's, like, extremely accurate, and it moves really fast and tracks you the second it sees you and hits you from across the map. And it's kind of, it, like...
So it's, the turret is, like, playing... It's, like, a PC character.
Exactly. Like, the turret is, like... It's, like, jumping the skill ceiling on console. And, like, a shitty player, too, if you're in, like, a low level... Like, if... Because we're not that great, right? Like, we're not playing with the high-level players. That thing is, like, playing like a really good player. And so it just destroys everybody. And there's no question playing those matches, I'm like, this thing needs some kind of adjustment. Like, this, maybe it reacts slower to you or the range is decreased, but it's crazy. So I was surprised to see him listed in, like, among competitive players on the lower tier, which makes me think that maybe if you are really good and if you're playing on PC, you can be countered. But man, I think, in my opinion, Torbjorn turret is, like, the most OP thing I've come across in the game.
Yeah. And Mei is the most annoying character She just freezes you and then you
the
just
face,
like,
of evil.
Are just standing there, you can't move.
Yeah, it's the worst.
But yeah, I like Widowmaker. I liked playing as Pharah. I like playing as Reinhardt a bit. I tried playing as Winston a little bit. Mm-hmm. He kind of sucks.
Yeah, I guess I was getting killed by Winston some, and I kind of get what he's like a really mobile tank, basically. Like, he can jump behind your lines.
And he's super aggressive.
Right. And, like, just totally mix it up with people, which is, like, also not something I'm really ready to do, so I just haven't even really tried it with him. You know who I think is good that I haven't played at is Junkrat. Have you played Junkrat?
Yeah, a little bit. I've blown myself up as Junkrat, which is always hilarious. Because he has a grenade launcher, mm-hmm. and if you shoot it and projects off something and hits you, if it careens off something and hits you, you'll die. Or, like, if it explodes right next to you or something like that. Huh. So, yeah, I blown myself up.
Yeah, we were playing, I think on if you're playing defense, Junkrat seems like he'd be really good. We were playing a couple teams where there'd be like three Junkrats, and it's like he lays traps everywhere that blow you up.
Yeah.
And he's like launching grenades, and there'd just be, I would be like getting hit by grenades, and like, I'd watch the kill cam, and the dude is just standing like a million miles away, just like shelling grenades into where we're kind of standing and killing people.
Yeah.
And it was driving me nuts. And his super,
that's a pretty fun character,
is annoying. Yeah, I kind of want to.
The tire.
Yeah, it just, ugh, I hate that fucking tire. So, yeah, he's definitely a character I want to play as more.
Yeah, I want to try playing as Genji more also, because that seems fun to just...
Yeah, he's like the skill player.
Chop things up.
And reflect bullets. I think he can, like, reflect, like, Junkrat's grenades back at Junkrat and blow him up with them.
Yeah. So you were telling me you're enjoying playing as a healer, too.
Yeah, it's fun.
Which is interesting.
I think they did a really good job of making it fun. Like, playing as Mercy is fun just because you're, like, a really powerful healer, and you can, in the clutch, like, res your whole team, which can just be huge. Like, it's fun playing on my team, like, on any team as Mercy, because people are just always thanking you, which is just sort of nice. Like, they're always like, thanks, thanks, thanks. And you're always hooking
Mercy.
People up. Which
yeah,
is,
so
which
that's
is nice.
Her super, is resing everyone?
Yeah, everyone, like, in the immediate vicinity. So if you do it right,
okay. You
can, like, turn an entire match around. Like, if you're in the last minute... you know, of a push, and three people go down, and you just bring them back from the dead, like, that just, it turns the tide of an entire battle, so it can be extremely useful. And then, yeah, Lucio is just fun, because he's so mobile. The thing I found with Lucio is, maybe this is a little granular for non-Overwatch players, but did you know you can remap buttons for each character in this game?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I remapped, this was another tip I got from someone we were playing with.
Okay.
I remapped his jump button to the left trigger, and his, because normally left trigger is this like sonic blast that pushes people back, and remapped jump to the left trigger, and then put his sonic blast just on X. So instead of jumping with X, you jump with the trigger, because he can do that wall run. So suddenly you can shoot and aim and move, and then just jump and wall run with a trigger. You don't have to use your right thumb to do it. And
so you can do it. So you know,
yeah. So you're constantly wall running and moving, and people do not know what to do. Like because you're so on the wall all the time. They're just not, people can't keep up with you because you're so fast, and the aiming in that game really kind of requires precision, and it's pretty fun, like, especially in King of the Hill, like, when you have to occupy it and just keep the spot, like, just shooting around the room and, like, climbing on the wall and just going on and on and on and healing everybody and just being basically unkillable is extremely fun.
Yeah, actually, I think that the UI for, like, victory and defeat and objectives and stuff is kind of bad.
Mm.
Like, it's sometimes unclear who's winning and what you have to do. At least for me, as, like, a relatively new player.
Yeah.
And sometimes a game would end and I would have no idea why it's victory or who won until I saw the victory or defeat. And then sometimes it would go from... Maybe I'm being an idiot and I just don't understand the game modes, but sometimes it goes from one round to another round, and sometimes it just ends entirely. Is that just based on the different?
That's based on the game type. I think I agree that it doesn't communicate the game type that you're playing very well. Like, there isn't, like, really clear graphic being like game type, you know, with whatever it's called, you know, like,
yeah, I feel like it should start, every match should start with, like,
yeah,
King of the Hill in big letters.
Yeah.
And
to make
it
way clearer what you're doing. Yeah. I think that there's
also, you should
clarity.
Be able to pick. It's weird that you can't even pick what type of game type you wanna.
Can you
play.
Not pick at all? This is, I'm actually not sure about that. We always just play in whatever and just matchmake.
Well,
play
I guess
whoever.
I have only been doing quick matches, so I don't know
right.
if you can. And
well, I mean, you can do custom modes. Matches, so I'm sure you can. I'm sure you can
right.
play whatever mode.
But
you
then
want.
You would have to play against specific people, unless you can do custom matches. I'm not 100% sure actually.
Yeah.
But it does feel very bare bones, which is interesting because it's. It's really cool and it's really good, but it'll be even better in a year or so.
I think that's
when
definitely
adding
true.
All these
well,
new
and there's
features
stuff like
and...
on console, which apparently this is not the case on PC, but on console, the whole team management shit, like the social
oh
stuff,
my
is
God,
a, disaster.
It's a disaster.
Like, it's so bad. Like, how you have to, everyone leaves a match separately and then reinvites everybody to get into a group. You can't leave as a group. There is something else. I'm trying to remember what it was. There was something else last night that someone said, well, no, you can't do this. And it just made me like, think, how the hell is that not a feature in a game like this?
So, Kirk, what else are you playing besides many, many hours of Overwatch? We should do a quick, what are we playing?
What are we
days?
Playing? I'm still playing the Witcher DLC, which is great, and I'll probably never finish
cool.
it because it's long as hell.
Blood and Wine or Heart of Stone?
Blood and Wine, which okay. I'll then probably start a new game plus after that, but that's still good. The cool new thing that I did last week that I'd never done before was an elusive target in the new Hitman, which mm-hmm. Which is cool. Do you know about these, about the elusive targets?
Refresh my memory.
So it's like the deal is, you know, this game is always online, which has been cause of some controversy. They're releasing these episodic new missions, so it's kind of going to be coming out all year. And then in addition to that, there's kind of new challenges kind of pretty regularly that they introduce that's just like, use this weapon to kill this person or whatever. And the elusive target is a sort of timed event, basically. It's like you have 2 days or 48 hours usually. Like you have 2 days to kill this guy. And they they kind of send you a dossier. And so the whole thing is kind of done in like the Hitman style.
So it's within the world that you already have?
Yeah.
It's like within a map that
you've played? It's its own mission, but yeah, it's within a map. So they're on, this one I did was at the Paris map, but there's been ones in the Italian Sapienza map. I'm not sure.
That sounds cool.
It's awesome. So the idea is you you get a picture of the person. And like a, there's a whole little dossier, like a little cutscene that plays sort of, she explains who the target is. So it's not just like totally procedurally generated. Like these are actually created by them, and it's a new character who like is an actual character. It's not just some random NPC. But then you go into the, say, the Paris level, and you have to find, for me, it was this, I'm trying to remember. Oh, he's like a recording artist. And he's having a private party somewhere in the Paris building, and you have to find him and kill him. So the way it works is you have one shot. So if you kill him,
you only have one shot.
It really is like, it's like a permadeath thing. So if you get killed while doing it, it's over. You can't ever do it again. Like, so it just goes away and it vanishes from your UI.
Interesting.
If you kill the target and then die or don't get out, you also it's also over. So like, and you can't.
Wow.
Yeah, I think you also, I'm trying to remember, you can get busted. I think you can't. So if you get a game over in any way, that's your shot. It is possible.
That's crazy.
It's possible to screw up and really quickly pause and restart it. So like if you kind of, you know, in Hitman, like you'll get spotted and someone's suspicious or they start chasing you, but you're not dead yet. That I did that once. Like I was like, look, I'm not going to lose this.
Well,
like,
so this permadeath feels anathema to how I play stealth games, which is to keep restarting and over again.
Well, so when you, that's true, except if you look at it like the, in the big picture, it's sort of like, you know, the idea behind this Hitman is they release a new level and there's a story mission. So first you kind of play it how that way, like there's quick save and you can do whatever you want. You like track down the two targets and then you maybe do it a couple times like you used to in Hitman to get it really perfect and get Silent Assassin. Then there's these sort of challenges that are cool. It's like other targets, like, okay, like there's a cook in the kitchen and you got to go kill him. And then there's like a thing called escalations where you have to kill the cook, but then you have to do it again. And this time you can only do it while wearing this outfit. And then,
why are you killing this poor cook?
Because he's like a jerk. There's always some reason. They're almost always bad people. They try to justify it a little more in this.
He's trying to poison everyone.
Yeah, he's like, or he's like an escaped Nazi or something. I don't know.
Sure.
There's always a reason. But so like the next time you'll have to do it in a special outfit with a certain, you know, method. And then the next time you'll have to do it like without getting spotted and only starting here and like wearing this. So it like escalates and gets harder. So I think the thinking is that you'll have done all of those. And then the elusive target is sort of like your final exam. Like it's like you have to know the whole level. You have to know every single way in and out, which is definitely true. Like for doing this, I knew the Paris level really well and it was extremely helpful because I knew, okay, there's this model guy and if I go get his outfit, no one will really challenge me and I need to get
rat poison.
So what
do you get if you beat the elusive target?
I believe that if you do 5 of them, you get a really cool suit.
Nice.
That like, well, so you know, you can only
like
get
a,
if you do that.
Just doing it for the satisfaction.
Yeah, it's
doing it.
It's really fun. Our friend Mike Rougeau, Playboy Games editor, says that every time there is one, he has people over and they all get really drunk and they play together, which I think is a really cool
awesome.
Idea. Like they sit around the TV and they try to get the elusive target together.
Really cool.
Yeah,
oh,
which
cool.
I bet is a really fun way to do it. And it's made.
By
me
the way, did I tell
that.
You that I play the new Deus Ex at E3?
No, but now I'm jealous. I want to play that game.
Yeah, it's
good?
Cool. I mean, it just feels like more of Human Revolution.
Yeah, I watched that
like
demo of it. Yeah, and was basically
so
like,
something.
Fuck.
So refresh my memory. Tell me if you remember this
okay.
In Human Revolution when you do a. When Jensen does a takedown against an enemy, does the screen go black for a second before that happens?
I can't remember. I mean, it pops out to third person.
Yeah, no, I know
it
that.
Might,
well, so
yeah,
what happened
it might,
this,
actually.
Yeah, so what happened in the demo is that, and it was like kind of janky and like took me out of the game for a sec every time. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that would get annoying, or you would get used to it. I don't know. I don't remember it in Human Revolution, so either it wasn't there or I just got used to it.
Yeah.
Human remember. Revolution was a great game, and Mankind Divided is probably going to be
better.
Pretty great too. So I played it, and it's like everything is like slightly different. Like the UI is slightly different, and there's some new stuff you can do with like crouching and maneuvering around, and the tech tree is different and that sort of thing. But it seems like more Deus Ex. I'm very excited to play it. Yeah, that's August too, very soon.
Yeah, I know. It's like weirdly soon.
2 months away.
Can't. Yeah.
So I've been playing. I'll talk about this a little bit.
I know you've been playing something you're excited about.
Which is the sequel to Virtue's Last Reward, which is, by the way, if you're listening to this podcast and you trust my judgment at all in video games, and you have not played the Zero Escape series, which starts with the game 999, and then the second game is Virtue's Last Reward, and the third game is Zero Time Dilemma, which comes out next week. If you have not played that series, I very strongly recommend that you do so, because it's some of the best storytelling in video games and some of the coolest games that you will ever play, that are like these insane stories that can only be told through the video game format. They're like horror, sci-fi, mystery, everything you would want in a good story is it's all there. Even anime and women with giant cleavage, it's just like inexplicably there. It's just like a woman who's just wearing this ridiculous exposed outfit with breasts that don't move at all, because the animation is all kind of like low production, so it's just the most bizarre thing.
I guess some
people are into that, but it's not even attractive, because it feels so plastic and fake. Like, I feel like there are ways that she could wear an outfit that is a lot sexier than just like a giant, but whatever, I won't get started on that. Point is, these games are fantastic, and I've been playing the new one, and it's been keeping me up all night, because it is really good, really well done. It's actually, you saw a preview of it, so you know this, but so the first two games, 999 and Virtue's Last Reward, are both visual novels, so it's a lot of reading. The first one even has prose. Like descriptions of some of the horrifying stuff that you see. But the third one actually switches over to cinematics, where everything is voiced and you don't actually have to read, because you can just watch things play out. I'm not sure if I love the switch, but it, because the animations are so bad and the dubbing is not very good either, but the cinematic approach definitely makes it feel more accessible for people who don't like reading many
words.
It's
interesting that, given that the writing is easily the strongest thing about these games, that a move that to them I'm sure feels like progress in some ways moves away from the strength of the game and onto
because
acting.
It's still all
it's
there.
Still written. No. There's still voice acting.
Yeah, it's still, the dialogue is still fantastic. The scenes are still fantastic. They still go on all these like tangents about philosophical concepts and scientific terms, and it still goes really crazy. It still gets really powerful and interesting. And man, I saw a scene last night that I will not spoil or even hint at, but it was pretty crazy. And I'm not. I think I have a little bit left to go in the game. It's really cool.
So the idea is, and I don't think there's anything official, is that the first two games are going to be on PC at some point, so it'll be possible for people to play them.
Yeah, I think so. That's what they've been hinting at. PC, the first one right now is just on DS and iOS.
Yeah.
The second one, I believe, is on 3DS and Vita. And yeah, I think they'll all be on PC.
Yeah.
And the basic concept, in case you haven't heard of any of these games, is that in each of the games, nine people are trapped in a certain place. It changes based on the game. And they're told they have to play a game. And the game differs based on which game you're playing. In the first game, it's called the Nonary game. In the second one, it's called the AB game. In the third one, it's called the Decision game. But the point is, you have to find some way to escape with it. And usually that means killing people. Usually that means everyone has to kill each other and someone has to die. So
there's
like
a lot
in
of like
Zero Time,
Saw-like sort of contraptions.
It is very Saw. Yeah. It is very Saw. So in the most recent one, Zero Time Dilemma, the one I'm playing now, the concept is there are nine people divided into three teams of three people each, and six of those people have to die for the other three to be able to escape. Just straight up, like six people have to die. And so the game actually begins by asking each team to pick a team to execute, and whichever team gets two votes so two of the other teams for that team to be executed, they all immediately die.
Wow.
So from the beginning, you have to choose, and you'll wind up playing as all three teams throughout the game. So the first choice you make is for each team, who do you want to execute?
Wow.
And I won't say much more, but yeah, so there's a big flowchart like there was in Virtue's Last Reward, and there's a lot of time travel and shifting through timelines, and like that's always been a big concept of the series is that like it's very interesting because it asks you to make decisions, and then the game actually explores like the different results of those decisions and like how those decisions impact like how the player impacts the game, and it's really weird and crazy and surreal and fascinating, and these games are incredible. I strongly recommend them to anyone who likes good storytelling in their video games.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of good puzzles in this one. And Kirk, you remember, so when you did the preview, do you remember they showed you something and were like, we don't know what's going to happen. It's a 50-50 chance.
Yeah, it was confusing. Like, I still didn't quite understand how that worked.
Yeah, so I thought that was... So basically, they showed you a scene where some characters were in this room, and one character had to decide whether to pull the trigger on a gun.
That may or may not be loaded.
50-50 shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it had a 50-50 chance of going off, and then... If you don't pull it at all, the other person who's in the incinerator dies because she'll get burned up by the incinerator. So you have to choose whether or not to pull it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are three outcomes. So either you leave him alone and she dies, or you pull the trigger and he dies and she survives, or you pull the trigger and it's a blank and everyone survives. So anyway, so it's true that that's a random chance element. And I was wondering when you previewed that, like how is that in this game that's so heavy on the story and scripts and the script and like the specific narrative, how do you deal with random chance like that? Because how can they tell a coherent story if the game doesn't like has to have two possibilities for whether someone lives or dies? But don't worry, it's kind of a fake out because you can explore every single possible ending.
The sense they gave me was something vague about that, since obviously they didn't want to spoil stuff, but I asked about it because I was really trying to get to the bottom of like how this was possible, and they kept kind of smiling and just saying, "Well, it all makes sense." And I was like, "All right, whatever. Like, I'm sure I'll just take your word for it." Like,
well, and also that was kind of a weird selling point because that only happens in that one scenario, really.
Oh, I mean, so they were just kind of having fun with that scene.
Like, yeah, I think so. There are a couple other scenes where it like explores that, but I mean, the thing that fans I think were worried about, that I was worried about a little bit. To alleviate that fear, you can play the entire game once and see everything. You don't have to like keep like saves coming or like be like start new saves just to see what happens with the random stuff. Like the random stuff is not something you have to worry about.
Yeah, that was I think kind of what they said. It's like it's not going to be a situation where you just reload your save. Like you want to get all the possible outcomes and like see what happens. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I imagine I'll talk more about that once it's out. Maybe I'll talk about it with some of our guests or with you in the future when you play it, because you still have to play those games.
Yeah, but though I lost my DS copy of 999, so I'm kind of waiting for that to come on PC. And I gather I want to play that before VLR. I'm not in a huge rush. I'll play them in order. Like, I liked what I played of 999, and I liked what I played of VLR, and I liked what I saw of the new ones, so I will probably play them at some point for sure.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Yeah, that's the other thing. So I still have to beat the new one. And then I'll be able to definitively say whether you can enjoy it without having played the first two. But so far, I would very strongly recommend just starting from 999 and playing all three of them.
Yeah.
It's kind of because it's one ongoing story, and they're all very, very connected.
And they're all very similar, and it isn't like technology, like, you know, makes one better than another or anything like that.
Right.
Like,
well, no, that's not true. The first one has some issues. Like, so the whole having to play it multiple times thing. In the second and third one, they do it a lot better. And the first one, you literally had to restart the game and you could fast forward text, but you had to repeat some of the puzzle rooms several times in order to see the true ending. Mm. So you have to, it can get a little annoying. I hope the Steam version finds a way of fixing that, because just by letting you skip puzzle rooms that you've already done, because that was annoying, an annoying part of the first game. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, but it's necessary to play the first one before you play the second one. And then I think it's going to be necessary to play the second one.
I'd imagine at that point, it's like you might as well just play all of them.
Yeah, I mean, four of the characters in of the main nine characters in the third one are all returning characters from the first two games. So, So I think that is it for the what we are playing section of this podcast. Yes. Should we move into Thrones?
We should move into the what we are watching section of the podcast.
Yeah, well, so... quick spoiler warning, we're now, if you have not seen this week's Game of Thrones or do not care about Game of Thrones, now is the time to stop listening.
Yes.
And you will also be, if you do not watch Game of Thrones, you will be sad to know that on Sunday night, Kirk and I are going to do another bonus, very special Game of Thrones episode that we're going to record, hopefully right after the season finale, if all goes according to plan.
If your flight doesn't get delayed on the way from the finale.
If my flight from work to home doesn't. And get delayed. So that's the plan. Turn off the show now if you do not care about Game of Thrones or you did not see this episode of Game of Thrones. You're not all caught up.
Episode being Battle of the Bastards.
The Battle of the Bastards.
Season 6, Episode 9.
So what'd you think? Cool episode, huh?
Yeah, I liked it. I had some complaints, but I really thought it was pretty amazing. I wanted to text you. I feel like we haven't really talked about it because I was like,
because
we're going to talk about it.
Yeah,
we're going to talk about it on the podcast, so I don't want to like blow my wad early. I thought it was an amazing episode in a lot of ways, and that the most satisfying stuff was maybe the stuff I was not expecting and was maybe not the most obviously satisfying stuff about the show.
Like what?
I like the stuff with Daenerys and Tyrion and the Greyjoys. I like thought that whole thing was really cool. Like not so much the way they dealt with the Wise Masters, but the scene, specifically the scene with like Yara, Asha, whatever you want to call her, and talking to Daenerys.
Daenerys is way too hot for Yara.
No way. You really think so? I think Yara and Daenerys.
No, I mean, they're a cute couple, but like, I don't know. I feel like Daenerys with the what's her face? One of her maidens from the Khalazar.
Yeah, that was like in the books, right?
But that was such a they were better suited for each other than Daenerys and Yara. I don't know. I guess they could be
two strong women leaders.
It was fun, but it wasn't.
I mean, for me, it wasn't the shipping aspect of it. As fun as that was, and as cool as it was more this sort of. It felt like the first, or not the first, but it felt like a major thematic moment of like thematic confluence on the show for me. That I sometimes think this show like. Seems like it's about something, but doesn't always say what it's about. And in the case of that scene, I felt like there's a back and forth between Daenerys and Yara where she says, you know, your father was a shit king, basically. And Yara's like, I heard the same thing about your dad. And you kind of realize, and then she says something, and then Tyrion is there too. And they say this thing about, it was also funny, by the way, that this aired on Father's Day. But they say this thing, it's like all of our fathers were... horrible men who made the world a worse place. And you think like, damn man, like, yeah, you've got like the Mad King, Tywin Lannister, and what's his name? What was his name? The
Balon, Balon,
yeah,
Greyjoy.
Balon Greyjoy, who were all terrible in their own way and like killed so many innocent people and caused so much fucked up shit to happen.
A game of bad dads.
It really is bad dad fest. And to hear them kind of say that and to have those characters in the same room together and to sort of say, okay, like, we're going to make the world a better place. That's our plan, is to leave the world better than
we entered it.
Well, maybe not, but probably not. Maybe even.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a lot of faith in either Daenerys or Yara to make the world a better place. I would have more faith in Tyrion to make the world a better place.
Well, and that was another... I'll get to that in a second, I guess. But so I liked that just in that it felt like an interesting way to sort of define the two camps on the show of basically people who just... destroy everything and people who are actually sort of interested in not destroying things. Like, and that I liked a lot. It just felt like more interesting to me, and it really struck me at the moment. I was like, wow, yeah, all these characters are kind of the next generation, and they're going to try to not fuck up where their fathers did. And then to what you were saying about Tyrion, I thought that was also an interesting thing about that whole opening sequence, was that he basically walked Daenerys back from the ledge, where she's saying her usual thing of like, we will raise the cities to the ground and kill everybody, and I'll take my dragons and I'll show them what it means to defy me. And he sort of says, hey, or you could be not an idiot and not kill everybody. And I like that too, because the idea of his like kind of wisdom and tactical thinking helping her not turn into her father is a kind of really important thing. But
how long is that going to last?
I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, I can see, after that, I can see that being the future for Daenerys, just like getting, like changing, evolving in smart ways because of Tyrion's influence and not going all batshit insane. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And I definitely think that this season is going to end, or like one of the last images of the season will be her finally sailing off to Westeros.
Yeah, I think so too.
With her army on the boats.
Which,
and
like, thank God, it's about fucking time. but I think it's an open question whether it'll work as well. Just because, like, on the show that this season has felt kind of like, where stuff actually goes right and we get the payoffs we expect, you would think, Tyrion helps her become better and she improves and it's about her journey of improvement. But on like Game of Thrones, like Song of Ice and Fire Game of Thrones, like actually Tyrion gets killed somehow and Daenerys winds up trying to kill everybody
and dies.
Well,
that's the funny thing. Like, you know, it's like the season of the show that has the least amount of source material is also the one that has the most like fan-loving payoff, which is kind of like not really in the spirit of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And like everyone's like cheering for Sansa and Jon reuniting and Dany coming back and blowing things up and destroying the Masters, and then like Sansa getting her revenge on Ramsay Bolton, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit. But like, that stuff, I don't know. It makes me want to see what George R. R. Martin has, because that's what the real like Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones is. It's not any of this. I mean, I can't imagine that most of this stuff is done the same way in the books.
Right. I agree. So I guess that's the end of the Marine stuff. But to move on to the Battle of the Bastards.
Battle of the Bastards. Yeah, which is very much like a TV.
That episode name on its own. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, I thought that was an incredible battle. It was incredibly well directed and shot and like gritty, and like it felt like war in a way that no other scene in Game of Thrones has. It was like claustrophobic and like gruesome and hard to watch, and it was all really well handled, but it also just had that kind of narrative arc of any TV show in a way that the actual Game of Thrones, George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones, does not. And like, I wonder, like, his version of that, well, I guess his version is the Battle of Winterfell in the books, which we might see in the next book between Stannis and Ramsay. I don't know if he'll have Jon get resurrected and then come down and do similar things, but if he does, I can't imagine it would end in quite that same way, without more heartbreak and more unexpected twists.
I agree that I thought it was a really amazing sequence. It was definitely the first full-on battle sequence they've had the budget to do on the show. There was some stuff in that. I mean, that tracking shot of Jon Snow fighting his way through the cavalry is just complete madness descends on him. Fucking unbelievable. And even more unbelievable is the part where he's like suffocating. That was incredible, like, and terrifying.
Really
and
incredible.
Just really, really amazing shit. Part of it was that it felt inevitable, the whole thing, the whole battle to me. I kind of, which is weird. It wasn't so much that I didn't like it. It was just that it was odd for this show, because it's so rare on this show that you go in to a big conflict like that, and you just like, I just knew, I was like, well, okay, yeah, like Sansa's gonna kill Ramsay, they're gonna take back Winterfell, Rickon's gonna die, the giant's probably gonna bite it, and maybe Tormund is gonna get killed or something, or crippled
also, you kind of knew as soon as Ramsay said my dogs haven't been fed, like, he's gonna go
there was
way.
A lot, so it just felt in a way that Game of Thrones hasn't before, which is also interesting. It's interesting on a couple of levels. It felt predictable in a way that Game of Thrones hasn't before, which is weird to say, because almost everything that's happened on Game of Thrones before now, I knew what was going to happen because I read the books. And yet at the same time, this still felt more predictable, which is odd. And also, like, I was comparing it, I was talking to my sister about this yesterday, and comparing it to the Battle of the Blackwater, which was another kind of set piece episode that was it was kind of their first great one location episode that now kind of episode 9 or 8 always does that each season, where Tyrion marshals the forces of King's Landing to fight off fighting off Stannis, and then Renly rides to the rescue at the last second, right? Am I getting this right? These names right?
Tywin wearing Renly's armor, right? So Renly's
That's
dead.
What it is. Okay, I knew I was flipping something around. So it's got a similar rhythm, like with the last minute victory. But when you think about that, and then especially in the books, what happens there is basically it's such a shitty victory. Like, it's, for starters, it's you're not really sure who to root for because you like Tyrion. And you like you want him to prove himself and to like be a great leader, but also he's kind of defending shitty people who stole the throne, and Tywin is a complete asshole, and so you're like, I don't know how I feel about this. And then he wins, and his strategy is successful, and the whole trick with the wildfire is successful. And then he gets, like, Cersei tries to assassinate him, and he gets horribly disfigured and just, like, winds up waking up in a basement, like, 3 weeks later or something, and everyone has kind of forgotten he's there, and he didn't get any credit for it.
Even in victory, it's like a shitty victory. Yeah, you're totally right. And this is the first real battle where it's been like, oh, yes, good has triumphed over evil.
Yeah, this really was just like, very clear.
Even though, and like, okay, yeah, they killed Rickon, but nobody cares about Rickon.
First off,
why was he running in a straight line? Why didn't he just do some fucking
zigzags? Everybody has said the same thing, but that was driving me nuts during that scene. I'm like, dude, bob and weave. Like,
how stupid are you?
Like, bob and weave. That was a little ridiculous. And I also, a thing that bummed me out, is a minor thing to complain about, but I thought it was annoying that, you know, 1-1, like, the giant knocks down the door, and I thought that was really cool. And he, like, kind of dies doing it, which I thought was fine. But I thought it was fucking annoying that, like, Ramsay Bolton fires the final arrow into his eyeball, like, to kill. It's like Ramsay Bolton killed the only two characters single-handedly with his dumb bow and arrow, like, in this battle where, like, thousands of people died. I thought that was kind of dumb. But
it's all very TV in a way that no other Game of Thrones season has been. And I think that's why, and don't get me wrong, I think this season has been great, much better than the last season, which was like a TV bastardization of book 5 and book 4, especially the Dorne stuff, my God. But anyway, but this is all very, like, it feels very like really good television.
Yeah.
But even really good television follows these arcs and patterns that Game of Thrones has never done before.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It'll be interesting to see, like it's easy for us to predict, and I bet that we could say right now, oh, I bet Cersei is going to accidentally or intentionally set the entire city of King's Landing on fire with all the wildfire, because that's been foreshadowed so much. Oh, Dany's going to go off to Meereen. Oh, Jon is going to go down to the crypt to bury Rickon and somehow see a vision of Bran and find out that Lyanna is his mom and Rhaegar's his dad and learn that at the end of the season. Like, that sort of stuff, it feels, and I could be totally wrong, none of that could happen. And,
but those, like, types of predictions, like, are the kinds of predictions that now feel like fair game for the show.
Exactly, and it all feels like it's probably going to happen that way because they only have so many episodes left and they have different plot threads to hit and things to do, and like we knew they had to get rid of Ramsay. Now we know they'll have to find some way to get rid of Euron Greyjoy and make him the big bad. But like in the books, because it's so much more complicated, and I hate to sound like one of those douchebags who's like, oh my god, the books are so much better, but they really are because they're so much more complicated and so have so many other plot threads to juggle that. Well, that can be a bad thing sometimes.
Yeah,
but
that's the
also
thing.
It makes it way less predictable.
Like, better or worse is kind of reductive. Like, I agree the books are more effective at a lot of things. And the show is dope. This season, like, I can't deny that every single Sunday I'm, like, fucking psyched. I feel like I text you every Sunday and I'm like, oh man, Game of Thrones tonight.
And I'm excited.
Like, I'm excited as hell to watch the finale just because it's like watching a really good TV show. But you're right in that it feels like there's just a lot more, a lot more shortcutting going on, and it's kind of added up over the course of the season. Like, the whole Arya plotline for me has been the biggest shortcut, I think, for a lot of people. Like, just the way that went down, the whole resolution. Honestly, at this point, like, I wanted there to be one of those theories to be true, like that the Waif doesn't exist and Arya has imagined her as the one, and that would have been cool.
I don't know.
They're interesting, right? So there's this other theory that Charlie Jane Anders wrote, and there's a point to this, so I'll lay out the theory, but then I'll explain. Right, I don't necessarily either, but I have a bigger point about the theory. But the theory is that this is going back now to the Arya plotline that resolved in episode 8, where Arya kills the waif, shows up with her face, and is like, and Jaqen H'ghar says, now a girl is no one. And she's like, no, I'm not. I'm Arya. I'm leaving. And so Charlie Jane Onder's theory, a former editor of IO9, now just writing for Wired, I think, was that the waif actually killed Arya, is wearing Arya's face. In that scene, he says, a girl is finally no one, and she says, I'm Arya. Then it actually makes sense. Like, the waif proved herself and now is wearing Arya's identity. Like, granted, I don't think that that's true, but what
there's no way. I mean, it just kills all the character development that the actual Arya has.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of reasons that that wouldn't work, but why, the reason that that theory exists and the reason I want to embrace theories like that is because of the thing we're talking about, right? Where otherwise,
the writing isn't so bad.
Yeah, otherwise it's just such a weird shortcut. We're like, okay, so she spent 3 fucking seasons in Braavos, like not even learning how to put on a face, and like what? And Jaqen H'ghar just apparently thinks that's fine now because
she learned how to be a better killer. At least now she's like a stone cold assassin.
Yeah, but in terms of how like meaningful most stuff in the books feels, or how it always it feels so deliberate and clear. And
well, it feels to me like what happened was they brought the showrunners brought Arya to Braavos because that's what happened in the books, and then either Jar Jar Martin doesn't know what's going to happen to Arya, or he told them what was going to happen to Arya and they didn't like it, so they changed
it
around.
Just shortcut,
but they had they had written themselves in a hole, so they had to find a way to get her out.
Which is like an unusual feeling on this show, because this show has source material that is generally so well wrought, and TV shows do this shit all the time. Like, even great shows, like even The Sopranos, and like has things that were just dropped plot threads or that
didn't really
go anywhere.
Well, The Sopranos does it intentionally.
Well, a couple. Well, I guess sometimes, but
The Sopranos. I mean, the point of The Sopranos is that nothing gets resolved.
No, I mean like specific stuff, like the Russian in the woods or whatever.
No,
like
I know that was very intentional.
Okay. But I'm saying like
everything in The Sopranos is perfect, and there's no room for criticism.
Okay,
except for that one episode. Whatever. We're not gonna. This isn't Sopranos talk.
My point is that even great shows do have plot threads that kind of didn't go anywhere, or like side stories that didn't really have a point or didn't need to take as long as they did. So it's not that much of a shock that Arya's time in Braavos would have that problem on a normal TV show. But because of the source material, it feels weird now that suddenly we're like, oh, okay, so I guess that was all just kind of pointless.
And for sure she has a different arc in the books, because there's no way that she just goes there to do what she did this season. I mean, that'd be terrible. Also, I would be very disappointed if the books do the same sort of thing with Littlefinger showing up with an army to save the day, like in The Two Towers when Gandalf shows up with his army.
Well, that's happened in how many battles in Game of Thrones now? Like, that happened at the Watchers on the Wall. That happened at Blackwater. Right. Like, it just keeps happening.
It's just such a... Yeah.
In this case, I'm actually a little curious about that. Do you think there's a chance that that is either Sansa... This would surprise me. Sansa doing it on purpose, or letting him do it because she's pissed at Jon, or Littlefinger purposefully coming in at the end so that he can have the numerical advantage?
Oh, no. I don't think it was any of that. I think it was just the timing of it. Like, he was far away.
Yeah, because that's so strange. That's the one big not plot hole, but inconsistency that I can't quite reconcile about the episode. Is why didn't Sansa tell Jon about the Knights of the Vale?
Oh.
Like, what the fuck, man?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like she was just being stubborn and, like, didn't want to admit that she asked for help and, like, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe she didn't quite trust him. It felt like they skipped a scene or something. Like, there could have been a scene of her.
I'm sure they'll talk about it on Sunday.
Yeah, in the episode, though, the whole time I kept saying, like, dude, tell him. And they didn't kind of show her even making the decision not to. It just sort of seemed like she hadn't done anything. And then, surprise, Knights of the Vale, that threw me. So either it could be they're going to something where, like, Sansa's become dark and fucked up as a result of Ramsay and, like, has become kind of a merciless person, even to her own, you know, half-brother or whatever he really winds up being. I don't know. I
hope so.
That was
Sansa,
an odd...
Sansa as a badass is awesome.
Yeah, that'd be a good plot. And it's, like, a kind of problematic badass, like, would be interesting if they went in that direction.
But, man, the books are so much better.
All right.
If you reread Dance with Dragons and Feast for Crows, and I know you have, right? You've read them more than once?
I started them. No, I've only read them once.
Oh, okay. Well, they're worth rereading because you pick up on so much you didn't, like, figure out the first time around, and there's so many subtle things, and then you can read about all these theories. So Danny has a bunch of chapters in the fifth book in Marine, and there's a lot of politicking there, and it seems kind of boring and pointless when you read the chapters, but then there's this one great theory online that talks about what it means and digs into all this subtext, and it's fantastic. And yeah. It made me totally appreciate it so much more. So I strongly recommend rereading or reading the books if you haven't already.
Yeah, I went.
We'll talk more about this on Sunday.
I went back just briefly. I went back to Feast for Crows and started it, and was immediately struck by, first off, how good the writing was. I think we talked about this a little just personally, you and I, when I started it, thinking everyone didn't like this book, but wow, this is really well written and interesting. And, I care a lot more about these characters now because I know where this is all going. I think
People didn't like it because A, it didn't have Tyrion, Jon, and Dany, and B, because it felt like things were not moving very quickly.
Right, which that's just how it goes in these books. I think what I'm going to do is do the, what is it, Feast for Dragons?
Chronological.
Where it combines the books, and go back and start over and just do those in order. I think I'll skip the first three. Maybe I don't have time, but I do think I'll do that at some point. Maybe after the season ends or something.
Yeah, it's worth it. And the first three are very similar to the show. The last two are not. Yeah. So those two, I think, are worth reading more so than the first three if you're familiar with the show already.
Yeah.
But really, the first three are totally worth reading, too, because there's a lot of stuff that obviously was cut off for the show, and some of it is good, some of it is not so good. I never enjoyed the Bran chapters in the books, but I think most people are that way, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so we will revisit all this on Sunday night. We will hopefully get that episode up right away after Game of Thrones ends. We'll record it and just throw it up.
It'll be a quick one. We'll just
keep an eye out.
Talk about the show, but it'll be good.
Yeah, so you can listen to us. So keep an eye out for that either Sunday night or Monday morning. You can listen to it on your way to work or whatever, and we will see you then. So as always, thank you for listening to Kotaku Split Screen. Leave us a nice rating, subscribe. You can reach us at splitscreen@kotaku.com. Every episode in the past few weeks, we've been we should get to reader questions.
Yeah, we have a few good ones too. We got a couple good ones this week that I want to do.
Yeah, I have a stockpile that I've been keeping that we'll hammer through. Maybe at some point we'll do a reader question only episode. So if you want to be in that, email any and all questions to splitscreen@kotaku.com. We read them all. We don't read them all on the show, but we read them all and ourselves. And I think that is all.
Yeah, I think that'll do it.
See you Sunday, Kirk.
Yep, see you then.